We'll start with a topic, I don't think it's going to take us the whole time, that is relevant to last week's Sedra and this coming week's Sedra, mentioned in both of them. And I think it's a foundation and something important enough to speak about at length. That's the following. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, Chaviv ha'adam shenivra b'tzelem Elokim. Man is very precious because he was created in God's image. Chiba yaseira nodas lo shenivra b'tzelem Elokim. It's an extra preciousness that he was, that it's made, was made known to him that he's created b'tzelem Elokim. If you have a tremendous talent or ability or capability, you don't know about it, so to a certain degree it's irrelevant. So there's a special preciousness of having it and knowing about it. And it's not just that people were told, but they know. Meaning there's an idea of knowing what it is to be created, B'Tselem Elokim, so you can utilize it properly. So it's mentioned in last week's Sedra, where man was created. We'll get to the Psukim and see the problems there. And it's mentioned in this coming week's Sedra also, where the Torah prohibits murder. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam domo yishofech. Someone who sheds another human being's blood, his blood will be shed. Ki b'tzelem Elokim asas ha'adam. Because God created man in God's image. So I thought it would be a good idea to understand what that means. What does it mean to be created in God's image? So let's see, there's two psukim in last week's Sedra that speak about the creation of man, and we'll see that there are a lot of difficulties between the two sentences. First sentence, Vayomer Elohim, God said, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man. First problem, it's in the plural. Who's God talking to? Who's the us? Let us make man. Bitzalmenu, in our image. Kidmusenu, in our likeness. Similar to us. The year du bidgashayam, he should rule over. So there's two things. There's tselem, image, and demus, likeness. What are those two things? And then it says that he should rule over the fish and the birds and the animals. That was God's intention in creating man. Na'aseh Adam, let us make man. Bitzalmenu kidmusenu. Then the next pasuk says, Vayivra Elohim es ha'adam. First pasuk said, Na'aseh, let us make. Here it says, Vayivra, God created. It doesn't say Vayas, he made. It says he created. Vayivra Elohim es ha'adam. In the first pasuk it says, Na'aseh Adam, without a hey. Not Na'aseh ha'adam, Na'aseh Adam. This pasuk it says, Vayivra Elohim es ha'adam, with a hey. Bitzalmo, in his image. Bitzelem Elohim barosam, in the image of God he created him. And here it doesn't mention a word about demus, that he created him in his likeness. Just the image. Zochor nekeva bar, and here it mentions that he made them male and female. So quite a few problems here. Why in the first sentence it mentions the plural, na'aseh? Why it uses the word asiyah, to make, as opposed to the second sentence where it says vayivra in the what's it called, in the singular, and to create, not to make. And it mentions in the first sentence in his image and his likeness, and the second sentence only mentions image. And the second sentence mentions male and female, and the first sentence doesn't mention male and female. And in the first sentence it says Adam without a hey, and in the second sentence it says Ha Adam with a hey. Okay. In order to understand this, many of the commentaries, not all of them, but many of them, say that the difference between Tselem and Demus is that Tselem refers to the external structure of the thing. In other words, God created man with his structure, his external structure, somehow similar to God. What does that mean? Since God has no physical being, how could there be a physical structure that's similar to God? So the Mefarshim explain that it means the following. It means that, firstly, it means that man has intelligence, just like God is an intelligent being, whatever that means. He has free choice. God has free choice, do whatever he wants. And man was given a certain degree of free choice. And man has dominion. He rules over the world. God gave him dominion over the world. That's what it says in the sentence. V'yirdu b'gashayam. He can rule over the fish or whatever. Just like God rules over the world, man has certain dominion that God gave him to rule over the world. These are all, to a certain degree, external things. Right? They're the structure of a human being that separates him from the animals. The animals don't have that kind of intelligence. They don't have free choice. They don't rule over the world. And man does. At the same time, it also means that God, therefore, compares himself sometimes to the structure of a human being. Since human beings are special, they're not animals, they're different than the animal. So the Tselem Elohim is what distinguishes a human being from an animal. In fact, in the second sentence it says, B'Tzalmo, in his image, in the image of God. Which means that man was given a special image to himself, different than all the other animals. All the other animals walk on four legs, with their head facing down towards the ground where they were created from. Man walks erect on two legs, facing up, facing God. So the structure of man is different than the animal, and the Tselem Elohim is what distinguishes man from the animal. And therefore, since man has a specific a structure, God sometimes uses that structure to define himself. Example, when God appears to the prophets and he wants to show them an image of an abstract idea, so he shows them something, for instance. He wants to represent to them wisdom. So he shows them a menorah, or olive oil burning, which is a symbol of wisdom. It's a euphemism for wisdom. Okay? So he shows the prophet a physical thing that represents an abstract idea. When God wants to represent himself to the prophet, wants to tell him something about himself, what does he show him? A man sitting on a throne. An old man, a young man, or whatever. God appears to the prophets as in the form of a human being. That doesn't mean that God has the form of a human being, just as much as a menorah is not wisdom. But just like the menorah is a symbol of wisdom, the human structure is a symbol of God. So that's also true. And also, God uses human attributes to describe himself. Yad Hashem, the hand of God, the eyes of God, the ears of God, and so on. And those are totally human structures. In addition, the human face is part of God's throne. Around God's throne, there are four faces of the Merkava, of God's chariot. One of them is a human face. So that human face also, the structure of the human face is something special. It's different than the faces of animals. The human face, called a panim, is a very inappropriate word for a face, because the face is the most external part of your body. Right? Most cultures don't cover their faces, at least not completely. And it is singular. Right? Even though I know a lot of people with two faces who are two-faced, but Lamaisa is supposed to have one face. So, a face, if you ask me to pick a Hebrew word to describe face, I would say it should be called chutz, external, singular. That's a face, is a chutz. Why is a face? Panim, internal and plural. Just the opposite of what it really is. The answer is, the human face has the ability to reflect, it's a screen. It reflects all the inner emotions of a person. It's written on your face. You can see guilt written on your face, fear, happiness, right? And sometimes all at the same time. So the face is a reflection of some of the most inner feelings, emotions of a person, And there are many different things that are written on the face at the same time. So it's upon him. It reflects the inner, and it reflects it in a plural way. So the human face, also the structure of the human face, is
what? Pan is a sag. Pan. Sag.
Right. Many sides. Right. Okay. So that is the idea of Tselem Elohim. It refers more or less to those attributes that make a human being special and distinguish him from the animal. It's not an animal. It's a human being. The Demus is not just that a human being is not an animal, but he can be like God. How can you be like God? So that already is more of an internal thing. That is that you can emulate God by emulating his character traits, his attributes. And in fact, the word demus, right, is the same letters as mitos, attributes, character traits. Mahu afato, have a halachto bedrochem, should walk in God's ways, he's merciful, you be merciful. He's gracious, you be gracious. So a human being has the ability to develop character that doesn't make him just different than the animal, that makes him godlike. That is the demus of the Ribbono Shel Olam, is a similarity, is a likeness to God. It's not just that his external structure distinguishes him from the animal and makes him something special, but it also makes him like God, not just not like the animals. And therefore, the physical structure that makes him different than the animal has the ability also to make him godlike and to give him powers in this world that God delegated him. For instance, the structure of the human body is 248 evarim and 365 gidim, whatever that means, right? The parts of the body. And they are the sum of 248 and 365. They correspond to the 248 positive commandments and the 365 negative commandments. Because the structure of the human being is on the one hand different than the animal, it also makes a person have a connection to the spiritual world where all of God's influence comes through man. Okay, and that's why it says that in the Zohar, and other Sfarim make it even more clear, that Tselem is the fact that man has the ability to be mashpia, to influence, to give over influence. And in that respect, it's compared to a male. Tselem is the male. Demus is a female. That man has the ability to receive influence, which is the idea of female, has nothing to do with men and women. Just like in plumbing, electricity, there's male and female. One is the mashpia, one is the mushpa, right? For obvious reasons. Right, that's the concept over here in the whole Bria. There's the male aspect of the Bria, the female. The male is usually the mashpia, the influence, the one who gives the influence, the other one is the one who receives influence. Meaning the following. Man has the ability to rule over the world, to influence the world. In that respect, he's not like an animal who's more of an object than a... But man also receives the influence from God, and it filters through him for the whole world. God's influence in the world filters through human beings. We are the clearinghouse. We're the conduit for God's influence in the world. In that respect, we're like, that's the idea of Malchus. Malchus, royalty, means that God filters through that midah the dominion over the world. And the Malchus itself is very much connected with poverty, because it has nothing of its own. It's a conduit, it's a pipeline to filter through it all the things that God wants to bring into the world. So in that respect, the Tselem is more man's active role in the world as a human being over the animals, and the Demus is man's more passive role of being the receiving station of God's influence that then goes on to the entire world through human beings. The Now, if that's the case, we've got a pretty good understanding that the Tselem is the structure of man that distinguishes him from the animal. The Demus is more of the form of man, the more spiritual side that doesn't just distinguish him from the animal, but makes him godlike. Okay. Now let's define some terms here. When the Torah uses the term vayas, nase, maase, it always connotes something complete, finished product, right? Making something, make a finished product, asiya. Whether as bria is a creation that is potential. It's not finished. It's the beginning, right? Potential, but it's not the finished state. It's a potential state. Bria. Bria means something comes, something from nothing, and then it develops. It's not created complete. Asiya means it's made complete. It's in its complete state. One more point. The Gemara says that only Jews are called Adam, without a hay. Goyim are not referred to as Adam. But Goyim are, yes, referred to as Ha-Adam, with a hay. Now, on the surface, it would seem just the opposite. That Jews should be Ha-Adam, the special man. And Goyim are Adam, stop. Why is it just the opposite? And where does it come from? So now let's go back to these two sentences, and based on what I told you, we can understand the sentence very nicely. God said like this, Na'ase Adam. God is talking now to create the structure of man that is different than the animal. So the earth was a partner in that. God created the physical structure of man from the earth. So according to one opinion, God said to the earth, let us make man. Right? I will put in the form of it, and you'll put in the chomer, the material. Or God spoke to the angels and he said to them, let us make man, because the truth is that angels are also created with the same structure, not with the same material, but the same structure as a human being. When angels appear to prophets, they appear as the human form. So he's talking to the angels, or he's talking to the entire creation according to some. Because man has within him all the powers of all the animals. Maybe in a small way, man's a little world. He has, it says, be swift as a deer, and what's it called, and strong as a lion, and bold as a leopard. Because man contains within him the entire creation in a small way. He is a microcosm of the entire creation. So God speaking to the entire creation, everybody will contribute a little bit towards this, the structure of a human being. So, and Na'ase Adam, when we're talking about man in his completeness, Na'ase, God is saying, let us create a man, make a man who is complete. This is the goal. The goal is this kind of man. What is he? Bitzalneinu kidmuseinu. Two things. He should have a structure that differentiates him from the animal, and he should also have a spiritual side that makes him godlike. Tzalneinu, kidmuseinu. Both things. Okay, that is the complete structure of a human being. That's what God intended when this is what God, man is going to be made. This is his final, finished form. Tzalneinu, kidmuseinu. Both of these things. Okay, and in that respect, there's no difference between male and female. Because when you have the Tzalneinu Kidmuseinu, it contains both of them. And the perfection of a human being makes no difference if it's a male or a female. It's the same perfection in the end. Okay. And here in that first sentence it says, Na'ase Adam, without a hay. This is the perfection of man. He can emulate God. He's different than the animal. That's the perfection. However, God didn't make people perfect. He made them in their potential state. So Vayivra, right? And now God is doing this alone. It's not anymore a combination of the angels and the earth and the... It's now, God now created that human being potentially with a potential. Vayivra Elohim es ha'adam. Ha'adam means human race. Ha'adam, the human race. Adam is each individual human being, is a different world. But Ha'adam is the human race in general. The human race in general was created in its potential state, not in its finished state, and therefore it's only B'Tzalmenu, B'Tzalmo. He was created with free choice, with intelligence. Everybody has that. That distinguishes us from the animal. But we weren't created with midos, with character traits that emulate God. That you have to get on your own. That you have to develop. You're not created with that. Right? If you were created perfect, what's the purpose of living? So you're created with the potential to be God-like. You were created with a potential to have, you have free choice, you have intelligence. Now use it and develop yourself into a model of God. But that's by Yivra Elohim, God created in the potential state Ha'adam, mankind, in his image, but not his likeness. Your likeness you have to provide. It's interesting, this difference between, and there's a difference between male and female. We're talking only about the image of God, so there's an image that's a male image and an image that's a female image. We're talking about the perfection. The perfection makes no difference, male or female. They can both reach the same perfection. It's interesting. On Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we say the following: Uvechein tein pachtecho Hashem Elokeinu al kol ma'asecho. Put your fear over all your creations, your what you made, all the things you made, ma'asecho. The emoscha and your awe over those things, kol ma'asha barasa, whatever you created. Again, the same idea: ma'asim, na'aseh, and bria. I like to explain it. Ma'asim means finished creations. Things that were created finished. They don't have to develop. Those are animals. Angels, like that too. They were created the way they're supposed to be, and there's nothing they have to develop. A shore, when it's born, is called a shore. When it dies, it's called a shore. The Maharal says, behemas, bo, ma, whatever it is, it is. It doesn't change. It doesn't develop. It was created with instincts, with certain powers, attributes, that's what it is. Same thing with angels. Human beings were created with a potential state, and we have free choice, and we have intelligence, and we're supposed to develop ourselves. So we are called bruim. We're creations. We're not made. We're created. And we have to make ourselves from that which God created us. And therefore, tein pachtecha, a finished creation is capable of being afraid of God, right? The imminent fear, but it's not capable of understanding the awe, right? Something that's beyond the imminent, right? Because that you need intelligence to know something for the future, to stand in awe of God. So the emoshkas are called mashibarasa. V'yira'ucha kol ha'maisim, finished creations can fear God, right? They can fear. But they can't bow down to him, because that takes also free choice and intelligence to know that you are bowing before God. It's a sign of obedience. Animals don't bow before God. They're afraid of him. An animal can be afraid, but it can't do anything. So, v'yira'ucha kol ha'maisim, v'yishtachavu lefanecha kol ha'bruim. Okay. Later on, a few paragraphs later, it says, v'simlo chato Hashem levadecho al kol ma'asecho. When evil will disappear and the world will reach its completion, you, God, will then rule alone over all the things you made. What happened to the bruim? What happens to the things he created? Why now does it only mention ma'asecha? What happened to bruecha? The answer is, though, when everything will reach its completion, there won't be any more bruim. Everything will be completed. Everything will reach its completion. Everything will be ma'asim. There won't be any more bruim. So therefore, when the Torah said Na'ase Adam, God was talking about, this is the plan, this is what I'd like to see the ultimate goal to be. This is man's ultimate state, Na'ase Adam. And that's Adam. Every individual person can reach the goal, but everybody has their unique world that they can reach, how they emulate God. Adam, stop. And that includes Salmeinu and Kidmuseinu. It includes a structure that differentiates from the animal, free choice, intelligence, but also includes what he can do with that and make himself emulate God himself. Then, when God actually created man, he didn't create him complete. He created him in his potential state. Vayivra Elohim es ha'adam. He created mankind, b'tzalmo, in his image, separate from the animals, tzelem Elohim, but not finished, not the demus. And he created them male and female, and together they reach perfection. So that's why Jews are called Adam, because Jews have more of a potential to reach that complete state where they can not only not be animals, but also be godly. Non-Jews are human beings. They're not animals. But to have that a power to be godly, that they don't have. Not, at least not in the intensity that a Jew has. So non-Jews are called Ha'adam. They're the human race. They're created B'Tzelem Elohim. They have free choice. They have intelligence. But they're not godlike. Jews are called Adam. Each one individual. That goes back to the first pasuk of Nasa Adam B'Tzelem. Now it says in Pirkei Avos this idea also. It says every human being, Chaviv Ha'adam, Shenivra B'Tzelem Elohim. Even Goyim were created B'Tzelem Elohim, and they're precious. But Chaviv Yisrael, Chavivim Yisrael, the Jewish people, are even more precious because they're Nikroim Bonim Lamakom. We're called children of God. What does it mean, children? Children means that you're like the parent. You're similar. You have the same character traits, characteristics. In fact, it says that character traits are passed on from one generation to the other. Right? So, therefore, we have not only the Tzelem Elohim, we also have a likeness to God in that fact that we're like children. And therefore, also, we're not only children, but bonim. We build. God influences the world through us. How does he do that? Because he gave us the Torah. That's the next thing. Chaviv Yisrael, Chavivim Yisrael, Shenitnu Lahem, we were given the tool with which heaven and earth were created, and God creates through us, continues the creation through us. So that represents the idea that all human beings are Tzelem Elohim, but not all human beings are Demus Elohim. And the Jewish people have those two extra things. We have the ability to be godlike, and we were given the tool to make ourselves godlike, which is the Torah, that makes us not only Tzelem Elohim, but Demus Elohim too. On the other hand, the opposite is also true. Both the Sfas Emes and I think Reb Shamsher Vol Hirsch, one of the two, says that even though the main thing is the inner, the fact that a person inwardly is similar to God, but it has to be in his structure too. He has to act like that. Just like we only recognize God through his actions, you only can really see what a person is on the inside from how he acts on the outside. So even though the main thing is what you are on the inside, how you make yourself like God in your attitude, your ideas or whatever, but if you don't put it into practice and you can't see it in the structure externally, something's missing. So yes, the demus is very important, but the tzelem is also important. How it appears, how you actually manifest it is just as important as what exists within. Okay. That is more or less an explanation of those two sentences. Okay, let me go to another idea from this coming week's Sedra. The Mabul. Okay? People are corrupt, and both between man and God, and between man and man, they're stealing, they're immoral, right, murdering each other, and therefore God says we're going to destroy the world. Okay, so he kills everything, animals, birds, trees, the topsoil. Now we just got finished saying that only man has free choice and intelligence to use that free choice. Animals weren't given free choice, so why are the animals punished? An animal can't be immoral, right? Because immorality means that you could be moral, and you choose. So what the animal do? They think it just followed its instincts. Why should it be punished? And if the animals are already punished, You know which animals were not punished? Fish. It survived the fish. Both. All these fish were big tzaddikim. Fish are really righteous animals. But it's just the other animals that were a problem. Birds or whatever. Why not the fish? And, okay, maybe animals, maybe they do have free choice. They have some intelligence too. But tomatoes, they don't have free choice. They have intelligence. Why would tomatoes destroy? What? It's a different topic. Let's just get to the ones that we know about. The what about the, what's it called, the earth? The earth has free choice, has to be destroyed. Okay, that's one question. Think about that for a second. Next question. Okay, after the flood, God says no more floods. Makes a promise, he's not going to bring any more floods, not going to destroy the world anymore. Okay. So, I don't understand that. If God had to destroy the world for some reason the first time, then if the world will reach that level again, then why shouldn't he destroy it again? And if God could ignore the fact that the world reached a level to be destroyed, and yet he overlooks it and doesn't destroy it, why didn't he do it the first time? And if the world will never reach that level again, why does he have to make any promise? Why would he destroy the world if it didn't reach that level? So any way you look at it, it's difficult. If the world will reach that level that it deserves to be destroyed, then why won't God destroy it? And if he can not destroy a world that deserves to be destroyed, why did he do that the first time? And if the world will never reach that level, then why does he have to make any promises? There's no reason to destroy a world that doesn't deserve to be destroyed. And the symbol of this bris, this covenant of not destroying the world, no more floods, is the rainbow. The rainbow is a prism, right? It just, you can make your own rainbow if you want, right? You can, and your sprinkler system, take what's it called, take a prism, put sunlight through it, and you'll get the rainbow. So why is that a symbol of the world not being destroyed? So there's other parts of this, we'll get to them as we go along. Let's discuss the first part. Before the flood, man was created, it's a little connected to what we spoke about till now. Man was created to be the purpose of creation. And everything else was created to serve man. And in that way, man elevated the entire world towards God. Nothing in this world serves God directly except human beings. And even though there seems to be a contradiction in sources to that, that one Mishnah says that kol ma shebara kadosh baruch hu bi'olamo lo bro elech vodo, everything that God created in the world, he created for his honor. So it would seem that everything that's created somehow serves God. It's for his honor. Yet there's another Mishnah that says the following. It says that animals get supported by God pretty much easily. They don't have to pay mashkantas, they don't have to buy houses, they get shelter, they get food, relatively easy. And man has to really work hard to be able to survive. And the Mishnah says, and animals were only created to serve man. And I was created to serve God, so I surely should get supported. The answer is no. Animals do what they're supposed to do, so they get supported. People do a lot of things they're not supposed to do, so God said, you have plenty of time to do other things. Support yourself. That's a mission. What does the Mishnah say? That animals were created to serve man, not serve God. There's another Gemara that seems to contradict this too. The Gemara says on Thursday, birds and fish were created to praise God. L'shabeach l'shmo. So it seems that birds and fish are praising God. They're serving God. Rashi there gives the answer. Doesn't ask the question, but the way Rashi explains that Gemara gives the answer. Rashi says it doesn't mean that the birds and the fish praise God. It means that when human beings see birds and fish of various species and they see the wisdom that went into creating them, they give praise to the God that created them. So what does it mean that the birds and fish praise God? It means they evoke that praise from human beings. That's what it means. In fact, there's Perek Shira. Every animal, bird, inanimate object sings a song to God. Some say the Mabit in Beis Elokim says it doesn't mean that they sing any song. They're inanimate objects. They're unintelligent. But it means that when a human being looks at these things, this is the song he should sing to God. This is what these things evoke. Hashamayim mesaprim kol keil. The heavens declare the glory of God. The heavens don't collect together anything. They're a bunch of dead rocks, gases. But when you look at the heavens, you see the glory of God. It's as if the heavens are telling you that. That's what it means. So, therefore, it's true. All these things are serving God and created for His honor, but all through human beings. Only human beings serve God directly. Everything else serves God through human beings. And I think there's a beautiful medrash. It seems on the surface cute, but it's a very deep medrash. It says the following. The medrash says, when Eliyahu HaNavi wanted to prove that God is true and the Baal was false, so he took 450 prophets of the Baal and he said, we're going to make a controlled experiment. We're going to offer two sacrifices. You're going to offer a sacrifice and I'm going to offer a sacrifice. And the one that the fire comes from the heavens and consumes, that's the one who's true. So he was afraid that the prophets of the Baal would say that Elio picked an animal that was conducive to bring fire from the heavens. So he said, we're going to take identical twin bulls, born from the same mother, identical twins, and I'm going to let you take the first one. You pick the one you think is more conducive to bring fire from the heavens. So they picked their bull. Elio took the other one, went to his altar. He looks back and he sees that the prophet of the Baal is schlepping this bull. It won't move. So he calls over a few of his friends and they're pushing, schlepping, and the bull sits down and doesn't budge. Finally, all 450 prophets of the Baal are there, pushing, schlepping, kicking, and the bull won't budge. Elio goes over to the bull and he says, you know, you're holding up the whole ceremony over here. Could you please get up and go to where you're supposed to be by the altar of the Baal? The bull says to Elio, nothing doing. You know, everybody got a good part over here except for me. You're Elio Navi. My brother's going to get on the altar of God and sanctify God's name. And I get this part to go and go on an altar of the Baal and desecrate God's name. Nothing doing. Nobody there. It's me. I'm not interested. Get somebody else. I'm not going. Elio says, I hear what you're saying, but you're making a big mistake. The same way that God's name will be sanctified when the fire comes out of the heavens and consumes your brother on God's altar is the same exact way that God's name will be sanctified when no fire comes down from the heavens and doesn't consume you on the altar of the Baal. So the animal says, okay, I accept that with one condition. You hand me over. You give me over to them. And Elio gives him over, and then we know the rest of the story. You don't know the rest of the story. The fire came down on God's altar. Okay, in any case. What does it mean? I think what it means is the following. The bull represented the philosophy that everything serves God directly. If that's the case, he was right. If he's going to be on the altar of the Baal, he's desecrating God's name. Elio told him, you're making a big mistake. Nothing serves God directly in this world except human beings. And how it affects human beings is how your service to God. And therefore, it doesn't make a difference if you're on the altar of the Baal or the altar of God. How's it going to affect human beings? If they see the fire descend from the heavens and consume your brother, that's going to sanctify God's name. When they see no fire descend from the heavens and not consume you, that's going to sanctify God's name. So it doesn't make a difference where you are. It's how it affects human beings. So the bull said, I accept that. But then I'm not a free agent. Then you use me as a tool to sanctify God's name. Hand me over. I'm not going myself. I'm a tool in the hands of human beings, so use me. You hand me over. In any case, so man was given tremendous dominion over the animals to the point, not just physically, but he elevated the world through his service, and by utilizing the animal, vegetable, mineral world, he raised it in service of God and took the whole world and raised it into service of God. That was man's job. Okay, and therefore he was given tremendous influence over the animals. But whatever is a power for the good has to be an equal power for the bad. That means that man's influence over the animal could be for the good, to use it in service of God, or to influence it for the bad. If man acted in a negative way, it influenced the animals too. And because people were immoral and corrupt, it influenced the animals to become immoral and corrupt. They didn't do it by free choice. They did it because they were affected by, just as much as man could have elevated the animals to a higher spiritual level, he degraded the animals by, what's it called, by being corrupt. He corrupted the world. Today you can understand that in two ways. One, pollution. Man has the ability to pollute the world and to totally pollute the animal, vegetable, and mineral parts of the world. It can destroy the water system and destroy the air, and you can also pollute all the animals, the fish, whatever it may be. So physically, you know that there can be physical pollution that contaminates the world and makes it that you can't live in a certain place because it's radioactive, because they buried radioactive waste there, and you have to totally destroy the top layer of soil in order to make it livable again. Even today, even in the world, we'll see that it's been diminished. There's still an influence that people have over the animals. I heard an interesting tidbit of knowledge years ago. I was driving in my car, and on the radio they were describing a study that was made. They must have spent thousands of dollars on this study. And they came out with the results that there are a certain percentage of horses that are by nature homosexual. Okay, so that means that it's natural in the natural world for certain people to be, certain animals, certain horses to be homosexual. So, and therefore, it's a natural occurrence amongst human beings too, that a certain percentage are homosexual. It's just an alternative lifestyle. I had to stop my car. It was such an absurd thing. I could have saved them a lot of money. You didn't have to make a study. You know, there are a certain percentage of animals that eat each other. They're cannibals. Okay? Cannibalistic. Animals that eat other animals. Fish that eat other fish or whatever. So let's make the same result. Okay? Some people eat meat, hot dogs. Some people eat other people. That's an alternative lifestyle. Because fish eat other fish. So it's natural. So it's a natural phenomenon in the world. So it's a natural phenomenon by human beings. Right? You know, animals steal from each other. So it's a natural thing for certain animals to steal. Therefore, there are certain people who are thieves. That's an alternative lifestyle. Certain people who are not thieves. It's just nature. It's absurd. You know that there are animals also have natural tendencies also, right? They have sexual tithes and appetites or whatever. But they're animals. They're not supposed to control it. Human beings for sure have appetites. They have the same instincts as animals. They're supposed to control it. That's the difference between a human being and an animal. Well, most are all of them have, hey, my, I could have saved them a lot of money. People are born with natural tendencies for sexual tendencies, appetites, whatever. They're supposed to control them and use them the proper way. So it may very well be that some people are born with tendencies towards homosexuality. Doesn't mean that they're supposed to be homosexual. It means they're supposed to control it. Just like people are born with normal tendencies and are supposed to control them and not run around harming other people or stealing from other people or eating other people either. So just because that power exists by the animal world doesn't make it okay for people to do it. It means that it exists. That doesn't mean a person now has to control himself and utilize those desires, right, in a proper way, in the proper time, in the proper way, and or suppress them if necessary. So it's absurd. But in any case, what I did hear after that was that in San Francisco, yeah, and those who are familiar with San Francisco, the pigeons have a greater incidence of homosexuality than any other place in the world. It's not because the people in San Francisco are influenced by the pigeons. It's the opposite. So what man does has an effect on the world around him.
How does that work?
Well, before, because man was given dominion over the, he's supposed to. So before the flood, this dominion and this influence was intense. And man could have raised the whole world through his free choice and holiness to elevate the world towards holiness. Or, as he did, by being corrupt and using his free choice the wrong way, he corrupted the whole world. Basically, polluted it spiritually. You know how to get rid of physical pollution, right? You have to, what's it called, come with chemicals or with whatever. How do you get rid of spiritual pollution? Something is polluted spiritually, that's called tumah. What is one of the major ways of getting rid of tumah? A mikvah. Water. Right? Water purifies. Okay. So now we have a contaminated world spiritually because of man. So man is punished. Okay? And certain people may be, wasn't it punished, but they were contaminated. They were made radioactive spiritually from the people who were what's it called? So now they also have to be destroyed. How do you destroy something physically and take away the spiritual contamination? Put it in the mikveh. So God took the world and put it in the mikveh. That's the flood. And that's why the flood lasted 40 days and 40 nights to create the flood, because a mikveh has 40 measures of water, 40 saw. The number 40 is very significant to a mikveh. So the destruction of the animals was because man polluted them, contaminated them, and not that they were punished, but God wanted to start the world again, and he had to first purify the world, decontaminate it. So he put it into a mikveh. Which of the animals weren't affected by man's contamination? The ones that were already in the mikveh. Fish. The fish were already in purified water. So they weren't affected. So they didn't have to be destroyed. That is, one second, that's before the flood. Then the flood came, and God said, I'm going to change things. Because man used that power that I gave him to contaminate the world instead of to elevate the world and purify it and sanctify it, I'm going to take that power away. I'm going to diminish it. I'm going to diminish that power. It's not going to be the same power anymore. The symbol of that, God is going to diminish his influence over man, and therefore man's influence over the animals will be diminished. Therefore, it'll never come to a situation where I'll have to destroy the world because of what people do. People will destroy it, but not the whole world, because man won't have the power anymore to contaminate the world the way he did. He may sin the same way. He may be punished. But it'll never be necessary to decontaminate the world because man won't have that power. I'm taking it away. What's a symbol of that, in my estimation? The rainbow. What is a rainbow? A rainbow takes intense white light, which has all of the wavelengths, colors of light in it, and it breaks it down into its components, into the seven different components and wavelengths, like Roy G. Biv, right? Red, orange, blue, red, orange, yellow, right, and so on. So what is each wavelength? A diminished part of that intense white light. That's what God said. In the beginning, I influenced man with that intense white light representative of God's influence. And because of that, man had tremendous influence over the animals. And because of that, he can contaminate them the way that he did. I'm going to now take my influence and break it down into its components. It's not going to be any more that intense. It's going to be broken down into the wavelength, just like the rainbow. And therefore, no one human being is going to have that influence over the animals anymore. It's going to be broken down into the various components, and it's going to be diminished and mitigated. So that's the symbol of the rainbow. Another thing that was affected because of this, after the flood, people were allowed to eat meat. Before the flood, they didn't eat meat. Adam HaRishon was not allowed to eat meat. There's many reasons for it. One is that, according to some, man had the right to eat meat before, but he couldn't kill animals to eat meat. He had no right to kill an animal to eat it. If the animal died, he could eat the meat. That's one opinion. After the flood, all animals owed their existence to Noah, who spent a year taking care of them. So now he got the right to kill animals to eat too. One idea. Another idea is that the world before the flood was an ideal world climatically. It wasn't tilted on its axis, and all the seasons, there were no seasons. Everything was like the equator. So it was the ideal climate, and fruits and vegetables and grains were able to develop all the nutrition that was necessary for a person to live. They didn't need meat, fish, to eat protein or whatever. It all was in the grains and fruit and vegetables. After the flood, the world itself became crooked. Man, like we say, contaminated the world. He also made the world crooked, and now it's tilted on its axis. And now that, because of that, there's seasons. And it's not the ultimate climate. And therefore, the vegetables, grains, and fruit could not develop their full potential nutrition-wise. People had to supplement it with meat. It's another opinion. Another opinion, which has to do with what we spoke about before, the Sefer Yikarim says, people didn't eat meat before the flood, and they assume because we are peers with the animals. Animals and human beings are the same, and you don't eat your peer, so we have no right to eat animals. That did not elevate the animal to the human, it degraded the human to the animal. Same thing, if horses can be homosexual, animals, then that's evolution, secular evolution. Man is just a glorified animal. So whatever applies to animals applies to human beings. We're no different than the animals. And that's why they acted like animals and they brought the flood. After the flood, God said, I want you to know you're not an animal. I want you to eat animals. If you're an animal, you can't eat other animals. You're a human being, and I'm giving you those animals to eat, and when you eat them, you should know you're not an animal. You're a human being. It's another idea. But according to what we said, there's even more essential idea. Before the flood, man's influence over the animal was so strong that he could elevate the animal, vegetable, mineral world through his actions externally. But after the flood, that influence was minimized. So how does man elevate the world? Partially by eating animals. Because the minerals go into the plants, so the mineral is raised one level up to the plant level by being ingested by the plant. The plants are eaten by animals. So they are now up one level, they become part of the animal. So they go from plant level, vegetable, to animal. When men eat, when human beings eat animals, so it becomes part of them, and now they elevated the animal to the human. That's why it says it's a dangerous thing to eat meat. Because a Talmid Chacham, a person who is in control of himself, can take the meat and elevate it to the human. But a person who's not in control of himself will take the meat and it'll drag him down to be more animalistic. So therefore, it says the people who are not in control of themselves and don't haven't worked on their meat, those shouldn't better not to eat too much meat. Unless you're eating it as a mitzvah, Shabbos, or whatever, because the meat can drag you down to the animal instead of you raising it up to the human. But that's why there was a necessity, at least, to eat meat, because before the flood, man could influence the animals externally. And after the flood, it had to be by ingesting them internally to elevate them. So that's an idea, at least, of why the Ribbono Shel Olam had to bring a flood and destroy the entire world except for the fish. Not because of a punishment, but because this is the way to purify a world that was contaminated by the actions of human beings, and why after the flood God changed the influence that human beings had. Therefore there would never be another flood, and that's why the rainbow is a symbol. Just short, another minute, there's other ideas behind the rainbow. Why is the rainbow a symbol? It's a symbol that really the world may deserve to be destroyed, but God's never going to destroy the world again with a flood. How is that a symbol? So one idea is that before the flood, it didn't rain intermittently. It rained once, I think, every 70 years or something like that, and a real gezunta rain, and it lasted for 70 years. But for a rain like that, the clouds had to be so intense, so thick, that it couldn't let any sunlight through. So there never could be a rainbow in the clouds. Because rainbows are when the sunlight goes through the cloud, through the mist of the rain, it forms a rainbow. But if the clouds are so intense, they don't let light through, then there can't be a rainbow. So I think the Abarbanel says it. So that's why it says, kashti nosati be'anon. There were rainbows, but not in the clouds. That's one idea. So now there are rainbows in the clouds, meaning the clouds aren't that strong. They let light through. So will never be a flood? That's one idea. Second idea. The rainbow looks like a bow. Bow and arrow. Except, it's a very impotent bow and arrow. How so? First of all, the rainbow always faces away from the earth. If you put a string on it and an arrow, the rainbow is the arrows are going up, not down. So it's a symbol. The bow is ready to shoot, but it's going the wrong way. It's not going to get you. Okay, it's going back up. One. Another idea. The rainbow is a bow, but it's missing something. It's missing a string. A bow without a string is meaningless. And it's missing arrows. So it's a bow that's facing the wrong way. It doesn't have a string. It doesn't have arrows. It shows that there's potentially there destruction, but it's been dismantled in such a way that it can't bring any destruction. So those are other ideas of why the rainbow represents that. But since the rainbow represents also the fact that the world deserves to be destroyed, had it not been that God changed the way the things work, the world would have reached a point where it would be contaminated again and deserve to be destroyed. You don't go around telling people about a rainbow because you don't give out bad news. So you can hint to somebody there's a rainbow to make a bracha, but you don't go around. It's not the greatest symbol, sign. It's a sign that the world deserves to be destroyed, but God's not going to destroy it. That's not a great thing. It doesn't make us feel really great. It says in the generation of great tzaddikim, the rainbow didn't appear. Didn't appear, at least in the clouds, whatever, because the world didn't deserve to be destroyed during their generation. So the rainbow didn't appear the way that it is a symbol for that, didn't appear during their time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When they sent the bell out, all the education wasn't destroyed.
No, it's, first of all, Rashi says over there, where did he get it from? From Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael was not contaminated either. And even though the flood waters went there, but the waters didn't come down in torrents, so there the vegetation wasn't destroyed completely. That's why it says it got it from either Gan Eden or from Eretz Yisrael. Those two parts of the world weren't able to be contaminated.
What happened to the raven that didn't come back? And the partner didn't have anybody.
Think about
it.
The analogy between the mikveh and the flood, I don't quite get it, because in a mikvah you don't die afterwards. You come out of it to purify it. But then they die.
No, so the idea is that these things, in a mikvah, a person just has spiritual tumah. But here it was totally contaminated by people's actions or whatever that had to be dissolved. Right? And the way to dissolve it, to take away the spiritual impurity, was with the water. And the actual physical dissolving took away the contamination of there was a physical contamination, physical and spiritual, and the two things went together.
With the colors of the rainbow, where they come from?
They are the components of light, different wavelengths of light, infrared and ultraviolet on the two ends, and everything in the middle.